Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 248, celebrating love and poetry during the coronapocalypse.
When I think of Jayadev, because of his name, I always think of Jayadeva, who was a great poet of toward the end of the first millennium in India, first common era millennium, who wrote a wonderful book called the Gita Govinda, which is a very devotional poem in Sanskrit. And it's something very, very remarkable and relates to the greatness of Indian culture and civilization. Why it was considered such a great prize and so many conquerors entered India, 100 nations really in India and 1,000 languages, I think. So Mother India is the original melting pot. It's what India only basically achieved, you know, in most spiritual contexts, except for a very few usually highly endangered mystics. Including in East Asia, the unification of the erotic, love energy and the spiritual devotion to God energy really never much occurred. So they had to be suppressed in a certain way. And therefore, sin and naughtiness was associated with the erotic, And also in some layers of Indian religion, that's also the case. But in the mainstream of Indian religion, Buddhist and Hindu and Jain, non-dualism in its great period from around 6th century of the Common Era until 11th century of Common Era, not just 10th and 11th the way people wrongly think, but the non-dual phase of that, or even starting earlier actually, maybe 5th century, starting originally from ancient time, but expanding in the culture ever wider circles. Some few elite people knew it in ancient time, but the larger population was not ready for that. So it made the dualism of suppress the basic life energy connected to the erotic and procreation and keeping the family and all that. And then the spiritual, which was sort of the sublimation of that as if it were opposite. That was more appropriate to the larger community by the Buddha's time and before the Buddha's time. But then by this around 5th century of Common Era, it came out. And Jayadeva's poem is so beautiful because it's the love of Krishna. But that love of Krishna is connected to the love between Krishna and Radha, which is taught as a kind of very erotic, beautiful, wonderful thing, and in a way almost, you could say, feminist, has a feminist message, which is hard to get across except in the esoteric circles in India, because it's very patriarchal in the sort of popular general level. So you have finally Krishna pleading with Radha to remain in love with him and forgive him for his polyamorous behavior before. And it's a hard sell in the poem, but beautifully done, just beautiful. And of course, he's able to do that because he's able to even abase himself to the feminine, to the goddess, because he's divine himself. So it's really, really wonderful. That was Jayadeva's great poem. And this is the coronapocalypse, time of the corona retreats everywhere. In this country, in the United States, And it's a crisis, and it's a horrible time. And of course, people are suffering now, for sure. But this suffering is not immediately created by the coronavirus. The coronavirus is only hitting at sort of weak points where regular suffering is definitely going on. And actually, if the coronavirus didn't hit those weak points, other things will be hitting them. And terrible things will be happening to the people who are unable to defend themselves because their body is weakened by being mistreated by the larger society. And they are the ones actually who are mainly the ones who are going down, whose immune systems are weakened because their confusion level and their oppression level is such that they are vulnerable, more vulnerable. So actually, we can use this time as a revelatory time. Of course, there's still suffering, but there's suffering all the time. And this is a particular type, but also it's teaching us this suffering. The suffering always teaches us. Suffering itself is, in that sense, good, in that when you suffer, if you understand it, of course, if you suffer and just suffer, and are resentful about it and upset, and you suffer that you're suffering too much, then you don't learn anything from it. You're just mad with God, or you're mad with nature, or you're mad with germs, or you're mad with the government, or you're mad with your neighbor, or whatever you might be, or mad with your own body, actually. Because unfortunately, a lot of the problems that is inflicted on the health of our American people are inflicted by a bad food business, a bad agriculture business, and a bad sickness industry, rather than health industry, let's call it sickness industry. And yet they love to blame us and say, oh no, your immune system is freaking out, you're having an autoimmune. That means that's getting you to be against your own body, thinking that your body is against you. And we have wonderful people like medical medium Anthony William and others reassuring us about that that's wrong, actually. That what is now thought of as autoimmune will someday be understood as a product of all kinds of chemical assaults and animal assaults, which release these viruses that are there a lot. There's millions of them. They're not just the one particular one, which is a bad one that's presently hitting us, but there's like tons of them all the time anyway. And this particularly heavy one is letting us see the injustices and the difficulties in our society and our way of life, and letting us challenge the idea that we have been indoctrinated in, that this is the greatest society, the greatest way of life, this corporate dominated, you know, entertainment, consumer industrialization backed up with a big militarist industrialization, that this is the greatest thing, you know, left over from colonial, you know, pillaging of the whole planet, actually, which was just a way of getting to know the whole planet, if finally it will be understood in history, rather than a stable thing. It never was stable. It had to do with instability about our culture. So now we are going to be growing up as a culture, and this is a strong thing to understand. So the first thing to understand is that will be very first and maybe very last, is that we are the happy human beings. We are the happiest. I know that's a shock. You're not used to that idea. Or you think of that maybe, I don't know, Disney or something, Cinderella. But then Cinderella's an exception, right? She's just plucked out because she has a fairy godmother and a magic shoe and a pumpkin and the whole thing. But everyone is Cinderella, really. The human being is the happy life form. We're love babies, all of us, love children. We're born of love. We're helpless for decades. Parents love us. Some are, you know, freaked out, don't love themselves, and they're not good parents. But most of them are good, and we wouldn't be around to criticize them if they weren't at least somewhat good. And so we are, and then the nature loves us. The nature produces plants, and plants are sitting here right now and producing oxygen for me to breathe and you to breathe. And then, you know, when the virus is making it hard to breathe that, and it will kill us if our immune system doesn't doesn't know how to handle it, you know, because it's weakened and it's poisoned and toxic, toxified by a bad lifestyle. And, you know, an inharmonious and exploitative and destructive lifestyle. And so we should be happy. And we are happy. Jayadeva is happy. I'm happy. I mean, I'm also miserable, so don't get frightened. You know, I'm miserable because others are miserable. And all of us feel it because we're all interwoven with everybody else. There are no people that we are isolated from. You know, those who are deeper on the hard, on the short end of the stick or the sharp end of the climate injustice stick, they're us, you know. Their misery in the ghetto or the slum or the homeless shelter is our misery. We feel it. We can go in the big fancy Pentagon or, you know, duplex or triplex on top of some big tower somewhere in the fancy area of the city, and then we just feel anxious, but we don't know why. And then we get nervous, we want a quadruplex, we think is the reason we're anxious, because we don't have a quadruplex. But actually that's not why we're anxious. We're anxious because other people are homeless, because they're like that, and the anxiety vibration wave is going around, you know, the vibe, you know, great expression of 60s, the vibe, you know. We share everybody's vibe. And so we're happy when most people are a bit allowed to be happy, because humans are happy creatures. Compared to tigers, compared to helpless animals, compared to even vicious predators, you know. We are not basically vicious predators. We can become that, you know, and we can be more vicious actually than somebody who only has their paws and some fangs and some physical strength, because we can invent mechanical tigers and lions and bombs and guns and heaven knows what. But we only can do that because we learn to work together and cooperate. Because we brought up that way. Someone cradled you in their arm and stroked you and colored you and went goo goo gaga at you, or your brain wouldn't be working well today. Even you grumbling about maybe later your parents did something you didn't like, but basically you've been, everyone, not just Mae West, everyone is dependent on the kindness of strangers, every human being. So that's the first and last important thing to know. Anybody who tells you you're supposed to be miserable is mistreating you, is brainwashing you with something wrong. You're supposed to be happy. If you knew your own reality, you would be. Even through death, it wouldn't bother you. You would be happy through death. Happiness would carry you on a wave through death into a better life. Because you're a beginningless being, you've always been around, in much less good forms than you're presently here. And you always will be around, and you can be even in better, happier forms than you are here. Which doesn't mean becoming a god, because gods are happier in one way, but their happiness tends to be a little imbalanced, and then they get alienated from the others. They don't realize they're still getting vibes from the miserable beings far down below the human, or even sometimes some suffering human. And so they are still, you know, not aware of the true nature, the true interlink, the true relativity of reality. So anyway, what I want to say is what I'm teaching you, and from what I know of Jayadeva, I think what he's teaching you, is not really converting you to some religion. Some people can, he has a beautiful religion. His original source was Guru Nanak, the wonderful Sikh people of India, who showed that even in an India that was riven between, in stress between Hinduism and Islam, that they could be knitted together, and there could be beauty and happiness there. In those days, the very wealthy India, even under the Islamic Mughal conquest, but with Hindus being still the main mass majority of people, he showed that with this new dispensation from God, Sikhism. And as a kind of merge, non-violent and peaceful originally, merge between them, and they became self-defending strong people, warrior people later, when they had to defend themselves against the more extremist, rigid, ideological, either Hindus or Muslims. And yet they still maintain a very powerful middle way there in India, and wonderful religion. You know? And so some people will do that. and Jayadeva has something of that in his heart. But like the real Indian mystic and the real Indian, you know, spiritual person, they've always been non-sectarian in the way Westerners understand sectarian. Sectarian is sort of the lethal way that you get divisions in religions that are kind of lethal, or between religion and non-religion that are lethal, where people feel the other one who doesn't have the same belief as them doesn't deserve to live, they're not truly human, something like that. And Indian spirituality, from I think the good influence of the Buddha, Mahavira, and some of the great Hindu mystics, I think India was always a society that had more of those people. In other words, that was why India, because India was wealthier from ancient times, the wealthiest, those river valleys, those alluvia in India were the wealthiest part of Eurasia. They were the most manageable, most fertile, most wonderful river valleys, especially blessed, which is why people try to come in and conquer it a lot. More so than the Yangtze or the Yellow River Basin, more so than Mesopotamia, more so than the Nile, actually. They were the richest alluvium, more so than the Danube, which was the only really powerful alluvium in Europe in ancient times. So therefore, India was allowed, people were more tolerant, and they allowed each other, they were less rigid in their ideologies, although they had their fanatics. So the point is, what we're meeting through Sikhism, through Buddhism, through Hinduism, when we meet it, is we're meeting a melting pot older than our early, young, few centuries old, experimental melting pot in America, always very endangered, always some people who don't like it, they want to revert to some kind of rigid identity, I'm white, or I'm Christian, or I'm Jewish, or I'm Muslim, or I'm something, or I'm atheist. They always try to, you know, humans will tend to revert back into some narrower thing. So we're just a younger experimental one. But India is the old one. And it has persisted through a thousand years of being conquered by outsiders in a way, which is a way of absorbing the outsiders, actually, and making them nicer and more peaceful, which they did. And, you know, the absorbing of the English Raj, finally, its evidence was here comes the sun, it's ashram, in India. And they started to be happier. And why would we love them all? Because they suddenly were making people feel like maybe they had a right to be happy. Rock and roll. Instead of you're supposed to be freaked out, and maybe after death, if you have the right membership and the right religion, then maybe God will help you, which is the other thing. So you're freaked out the whole time, you keep your own energy under control and sort of under suppression, and you're repressed against yourself, and that makes you vulnerable to repression from political authority and religious authority. So we're not adding a different one, is what I'm saying. That's what I'm trying. Sorry, I'm sorry, I'm a professor. I can't help getting digressing, and I'm a little elderly. But we're bringing some culture that has a different what they call the inner science. A higher psychology, an understanding of the mind, but not only the mind, also of matter, of nature, of botany, of herbs, you know, of breathing technique, of yoga, how to use your body. You know? Yoga is a kind of sport, an athleticism of this higher culture, but not an athleticism exclusively devoted to militarism, like football, which is a sport, so then later you'll grow up and join the army. You know? You'll fight in your platoon, you know, and kill. No. A yoga is a sport of opening your subtle nervous system, of feeling good in yourself, streaming. You know, Wilhelm Reich, among our psychologists in the 20th century, he's the one who really figured out about orgone energy, orgasmic energy, the streaming energy, not necessarily normal in some kind of normal huff and puffing thing, but an internal streaming, like orgasm in your fingertips, you know, orgasm in your earlobes, you know. Sort of feeling very, you know, melting toward reality and embracing reality to melt toward you, in that sense, orgasm. Not just particularly the one that you think of, we think of, which is usually all too brief, you know, and all, you know, replete with all kinds of consequences very often. So this is the thing. This is what we're basically talking about, and we're getting it from different traditions in India. We're looking generally at all of them. So what are we? So what we're doing is, what are we? Where are we going? What's the purpose of it? And it's the perfect time now. Everyone is on retreat because we've been sent to our room by Mother Nature because some virus that normally the animal kingdom, the network of insects and animals and subtle beings like what we might think of as spirits even, and therefore might disbelieve in, but you know, the more indigenous cultures know about them, and they usually have a web that protects the humans from such things like the coronavirus, the SARS virus, the MERS virus, the Ebola virus, all of these sorts of things that are coming from the animal kingdom, because we're part of the animal kingdom. But we've had these special protections, and also we've lived a little more healthily and intelligently for the most part, and so we have immunities to them. And some things that we don't, you know, there's that web that we're so busily destroying in the mass extinction where we're killing off all these species, even invisible ones that we don't know about, then the barriers between these animal viruses and the human being have been broken. And this is just the beginning of waves of this stuff until we settle down our pollution and destruction of the planet. We adapt to the much bigger crisis that is about to hit, that is already hit us and is intensifying at an incredibly accelerating rate, which is the climate crisis. The overheating of the atmosphere, you know, not just warming, the overheating and pollution of the atmosphere, which, and the earth poisoned by chemical and industrial agriculture, and the water dreadfully poisoned by runoff from industrial and abuse of animals, and the Holocaust of the way we're treating animals industrially, and the temperature is polluted. You could say the hot and cold fire element is polluted. That's the global overheating, and the air is polluted. You know, with all of these, you know, excessive carbon, that, because we've destroyed too many of the plants that absorb the carbon that we produce. You know, which they want to do, and they want to help us and recycle it back to us to be oxygen. Because we actually adapted to this planet and it likes us. When we treat it harmoniously and lovingly, it loves us back. Inanimate entities can also love, meaning wish the happiness or automatically produce the happiness of those around them. Because each being thrives by producing happiness in the neighboring being, and then this is a positive feedback, and that's life. So life is this the vital principle of this life is bliss and happiness. That's what it is. And we are the best adapted being to it, actually, to fully understand it. The gods are not so well adapted, actually, from Buddha's point of view, that's controversial, but from Buddha's, because they're too invulnerable. And we are sort of we're right in the middle, where we are very happy, we have a spark of extreme happiness, but we're also a little bit cautious, you know, and we want to really make it complete, and we want to bring everybody together in that happiness, so there's no harm anywhere in the universe for anybody. And then that means we become Buddhas, you know, Krishna allows us to be one with Krishna and the true mystics. It doesn't demand that we remain inferior to him. Shiva's a yogi, so smeared with ashes, he was a yogi, the other gods didn't like Shiva. If you know that story, you know, because they thought he was too funky. He was like a hippie god, you know, Shiva was, long before the 60s. And Shiva, you know, if you actually look carefully and you know about Shiva, Vishnu sometimes is a little more cleaned up, but sometimes not. Anyway, so that's what we're doing. So the first thing is, what are we? We are infinite beings. We have beginningless life, and we have endless life already. So it's not a question of, do you find endless life? Are we desperate to find it? We're so scared of not existing. No, that's not what we're scared of. If we didn't exist, we wouldn't be scared. We're scared of pain, existing painfully, unpleasantly. That's what we're scared of. And that's why, you know, the modern materialists unscientifically have talked themselves into not existing. And they gave that up. They gave up the soul and pretended to themselves and to others that they discovered there wasn't one, which of course they didn't, because how do you discover nothing? Who did it? Nobody did it. And nobody will do it, because it isn't there. So nobody goes there. Every energy is a continuum. They know that. They admit that about matter, law of conservation of energy. Matter is never destroyed. It just changes form. And in a way, super subtle matter, you could say, which is our mind, which is kind of energy, let's say. You know, Einstein discovered the interchangeability of energy and matter, so it's not mass, but it's material. And mind is not mass, but maybe it's very subtle material, like energy. Or maybe there's what they call energy is the bridge between the even subtler, super subtle material that is mind and matter. You know? And there are non-dualist forms that would have different views of it in Indian science, but it's not, because Indian science is science, the inner science. It's not just one dogma theory, oh, that's what all it is. No. Buddha was so cool. I love that. And I think all the great teachers in history, not just in Buddhism, but they all were like that. They were saying like, oh, I get it. Now I know, and I'm happy because I know, and I'm so sorry I can't really quite explain it to you. All I can do is help you find a yoga whereby you also can experience that. And the first step in that yoga is to realize that just having some theory, some sentence, some code, some mantra even, is not going to do it. You know, mantras can be helpful. Codes and theories are helpful, yes. But there's no absolute theory because reality itself is beyond theory. It's inexpressible. It's so much greater than any theory could be about it. If you're really fully open, you experience it yourself, and you will realize every cell in your body will be blissful. That's the thing. Because every cell in your body is ready to be blissful. Your health is your inner bliss, actually. And the more you doubt it, the more sickly you are. So theories that tell you you're not like that are actually harmful to you, in fact, when presented as the absolute dogma. In some ways, occasionally, sometimes it might be good to think, oh, I could be so much better, so the way I am is not enough, and I should be dissatisfied with it, and I shouldn't accept that I have to be like this, if as long as it goes along with that idea, rather than I'm doomed to be like this. Okay? Like even Buddha taught like what they call first truth for a selfless person, a noble person, an altruistic person, is that the egocentric way of living, the exclusively egocentric way of living, the unenlightened way of living is going to be unsatisfactory. That was his first statement. And that's to get people to wake up to the altruistic way of living, the loving way of living, the happy way of living, which is quite happy. It's nirvana. He said, that's the real reality that he taught. Okay? So that's the thing. So how do we meditate on all these things? Let's do little tiny mini meditations in the middle of talking. Okay, so now please set yourself to do a meditation right now. And in that meditation, first one is counting your blessings meditation. And don't get into a big philosophical struggle about, did I ever have a former life? Was I ever a gorilla? Was I ever a swan? Was I ever a dog? Was I ever a mosquito? Whatever. Don't bother with it. But just imagine that for somehow that seemed natural to you, temporarily. Just try it on for size sort of thing. So that you feel a kind of sense of empathy with all other life forms because you were one once. Just let's try that on. Don't either accept or reject. Just think, well, what would it be like if that was the case? And then realize that, and then trying on similarly to the future, I could be anything in the future also. And gee whiz, I don't think I want to be a mosquito again. I don't think I want to be this. I wouldn't even like to be a human being in some terrible situation, you know. And actually, gee whiz, I'm a great human being. At the moment, I'm pretty cool. Maybe I have a little virus. Maybe I have a fever. Maybe I'm even looking at possible suffocation and death. But at the moment that I'm human, at least I'm understanding this. I'm thinking. I'm self-aware. I've had love in my life. I've had pleasure. I know people who are loving, who love me. And I love the plants. I love the blue sky. I love the grass. You know? So this is really great. And not only that, I've heard about Guru Nanak. I've heard about great yogis, Yogi Bhajan, and other great yogis. I've heard about Buddha. I've heard about Dalai Lama, I've heard about Nagarjuna, heard about different people. And that's amazing. And I can even know what they said thousands of years ago. There was a book or something, might not be exact, might have been a little bit, some text might have made a misspelling or something. But I got the basic gist about their teaching that I should be able to be happy. So, great. So count your blessings. Count them. What a great thing I have compared to all kinds of, I could be a turtle, I could be a sickly frog in a polluted stream. I could be like a fish having a red algae bloom and dying, or dragged up in a net on a hook in my mouth, you know, being dragged up by a fisherman. You know, I could be all the difficult life forms I could be, but I'm this blessed human. And you know, people like Jesus and Buddha and Moses and Rabbi Hillel and Muhammad and Al-Halaj, you know, and Ibn Arabi and Lao Tzu and Yajnavalkya and Shankaracharya and Krishna, and these people, they all cared for me as a human being, and all the people fussing over me. Guru Nanak. But that's the first meditation. Counting your blessings, realizing what a great opportunity I have as a human being to understand myself, to understand my world, to cultivate my happiness, to even imagine maybe happiness is what I'm made of. Somebody said that. Well, it doesn't always seem like that to me, but maybe occasionally it has. And if in case that's right, wow, how can I work on that? What an opportunity. Amazing. So this is thinking the preciousness, it's like a wish-fulfilling gem of the human embodiment endowed with liberty and opportunity, which I have. And Buddha thinks you're great and you're to be congratulated, especially if you have tried on precisely the idea that you're all other different kinds of animals, even dinosaurs and everything, and somehow you worked your way to being this kind of social animal, interwoven kind of human. You know, amazing brain that you have. Billions and billions of connections. Measuring the billions and billions of connections in the world. Marvelous, opposing thumb. Flexible fingers, you can play jazz on the piano or Mozart. Amazing. And then you think about how there's no limit to how you can expand your bliss, your understanding, your love, your kindness, and how what that is really the purpose of your life. Because what else is there greater than being happy and making others happy? Is there anything better? No way. And making others happy doesn't mean you make yourself miserable either. The happier you make them, the happier you are. So there's a good selfish output for being happy. Bing, that's meditating on that. So now the next thing that we look at is death. Because that we're scared of it and we live in denial of it. And we think it's healthy not to think about. Because if you think about it, you're going to get all depressed. It's important to think about this. And the first thing you think about, when you, especially because right after you've counted your blessings, is you think of, there's called three roots, and we're going to meditate on that for a minute too. The fact that it's certain that I'm going to die. That's a root. And but when we first are called upon to meditate that, or we think about it, it would be interesting to do so. We our mind will object or will debate with our motive, and it will say, well, I don't need to do that, I know I'm going to die, everybody knows that. But then if we more deeply do it, we realize we act like we don't know it. I'm going to practice the Dharma after I retire, after I make my first million. I'm going to practice the Dharma when I this or that, after my children grow up and I'm an empty nester. I'm going to practice it whenever, you know. In other words, we just assume we're going to go on like whatever we are, endlessly. And you know, in the American culture until recently, when they're outside with the body bag all folded up, ready to bring it in, they had an etiquette that you don't mention to the one soon to be departed, and chart has been written, beep, 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 you know, they're intubulated or something, and they said, oh, this one's not going to make it. And of course, they're trying more things, and the relatives are freaking out. Normally now, sadly, in the virus thing, the relatives can't even go there. They do FaceTime. But there's an etiquette. You don't say that to people, which, of course, is incredibly stupid. Because if someone's body is giving out, they should be aware of it. And even, I can say, you know, Stephen Levine, if you ever heard of him, one of the great death assisters, death assistants, you know, death nurses that we've had in our culture since the 60s. I think he's gone himself now. He has a son, a wife, still carrying on, I think. And a lot of people, he was a creator of a big movement, or one of them. And he used to say that the people who accept their fate in a way, and they sort of find happiness within that they're going to expand, that they're going to open out from being in that particular body, are the only ones that he knew who had these miraculous recoveries, remissions, and so on. You have people who are fighting madly about it and stressing out more and more, often, most often don't make it. He had that experience. So, although you think, well, I'm a fighter and I'm going to fight my way through, because we have this wrong vision of nature in our culture that you have to fight with it because it's an enemy. And your body is never your enemy. And the world is never your enemy. Cancer even is just, in a way, your body gone berserk. Some aspect of it is gone in such a way that it's growing too much and it's wrecking the host. But it's all good, nice tissue. It's growth, 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 you know. Probably comes from too much protein. It's probably like, the one theory of cancer that I really like, beside the toxic food system theory, which is also correct for sure, the other one is excessive protein in our diets. So it's like a protein metabolism indigestion, just like diabetes is a sugar metabolism indigestion. You're eating so much protein that our system can't ingest it, so it starts to grow more tissues out of the proteins. You know, just grows out wild. And then that chokes us, you know, wrecks the liver or whatever, pancreas or whatever it's growing. You know? But it's actually excess growth, really, is what it is. It's what cancer actually is. Cancer, when they take it out, is not some dark-looking, weird, demonic, luciferian thing. It's just pink tissue, you know. Usually, I think, I guess. I don't know. I'm not a surgeon. Think about death, and when you do, combined with having first set the foundation of what a marvelous being I am, real self-appreciation, genuine one, not like superficial narcissistic arrogance, but a genuine appreciation of the evolutionary achievement of being human, you yourself having achieved it, really powerful. And then you realize you're going to die for sure. And then you realize, therefore, I'm going to use this powerful instrument of this human embodiment to the best effect. I'm going to use its essence, you know, as best I can. And then you add to the second root of death enlightenment is one thing you don't know is when you're going to go. And sometimes the young die before the old, the healthy, seemingly healthy die before the sick, the people in the safe place. There's some accident and they die before people in a dangerous place. You know, you can never say when it's going to happen. There's all kinds of, you know, life is very vibratory or tenuous in a way. You know, all kinds of virus can get you, you know, like an invisible thing. And so then you don't know that. So that makes your moment of life, every moment of your life as a precious human being, even more valuable. And then, well, the third root is key one, and it connects to the thing that I always harp on, and forgive me if I do, and maybe I don't need to in this group, because you're already yogis, all of you, or potent yogis and yoginis, and so maybe I don't need to, but in a way, I harp on it for myself too, because I'm brought up in a materialist culture where it was presented to me as a child as if some authority knew that you have no soul. That you're just, this is the only one life you have, and when it's gone, you're gone forever. There's no continuum of you. And we are told that as if that was a fact, or someone had established that as a fact. We all talk like that. And then even later we hear about the Dharma or something in India, or we hear about metempsychosis in ancient Mediterranean classical teachings, not necessarily India or China or Japan or any place, but we hear about that and maybe we have a mystical feeling on some surface level, on some ideological or good level, but we have an underlying still feeling like we're just this lump of matter. It's just, this is me. And I don't have, nothing will go on. It'll be nothing if I die. So we fight, we fear death. And we fear nothing. We go around being afraid of nothing. And then maybe subliminally, secretly longing for it whenever we're in real pain. So really in a imprisoned in a way in that wrong ideology, which is based on no discovery. Science should be based on experimental discovery. Experiencing something. Either, of course, material science as a measurement, or an empathetic experience of the condition of things by kind of merging with what you're looking at, what you're feeling. It's that kind, that's how science proceeds. Experience always trumps a theory about interpreting the experience. That's the fundamental. Buddhist science is like that. Modern science is like that. That's the great thing about modern science. The big dogma theories, that's their own form of priesthood, you know, of theology. Atheology, let's call it. So there's no proof about that, nothing. But the third root of death is, okay, so acknowledging that at an under subconscious or subliminal level, maybe I am thinking I'll be nothing, but I'm trying on for size this idea that I'm a beginningless evolutionary being and an endless one. And I'll be here forever in all different forms. I'm trying that on for size. So if I do, what is it that I take with me when I do die? Right, certain I'll die, don't know when. What goes with me? The Dharma goes with me. But the Dharma that goes with me is whatever I have encompassed in my deepest soul level, in my deepest heart level. That's the Dharma that goes with me. So in a way, what I've made mine in my subtlest heart, what my heart has opened to, it would, in a way, the openness of my heart. And what do I mean by that? Well, for example, if I've cultivated my generosity, if I've given great gifts in my life, and a great gift doesn't mean that I have to have $1 billion and give $1 billion, although that would be a great gift if I had $1 billion. But a great gift is whatever I did have that I thought was big and great, and some of that I gave, like a ring I loved or something that I was attached to, some ring, and I gave that to someone. Or a bracelet that I like, I gave, or some piece of clothing. And if I don't have lots of clothing, one that I give would be great. Or a meal if I don't have lots of food. Poor people can be greatly generous, and they give something even though they go a little bit with less when they do. So what is that kind of giving? It's letting go of something. And when you develop the pattern of letting go and realize the joy of giving and the feeling of release when you release, then that creates a pattern, an instinct for opening and releasing within yourself. It's an open-heartedness. When you're ethical and sensitive to how what you do affects other beings, then that means you open your heart to see things from their perspective and see how they feel about how you're behaving, what you're doing, what you're saying, how you're gesturing, what's going on. And then that's a little openness and the development of a little bit of empathy and altruism after being ethical. When someone injures you and you don't freak out and attack them back in immediate retaliation and revenge and tit for tat, but you kind of let it go, or you absorb it, let's say, and you say, oh, well, they didn't really mean to, oh, you know, it won't help if I just do it back, and then I just do it back, and it's endless, et cetera. So, you know, whatever consideration you use, you develop tolerance or patience. That's an opening. And that opens you rather than close you down and push back, you know, right away type of thing. So, and not to mention opening your mind to the magnificence of what reality really is, to the ultimate, to emptiness, to relativity, which I'll get to later, but these are these foundational things. So that's what goes with you when you die. So that's where the biggest investment, highest priority of your activity in life should be, into enriching your deeper soul, your soul instincts, shifting them. And that's another amazing thing about the Indic sciences, Buddhist, Hindu, Sikh, Jain, whatever, it doesn't matter. You know, you're taught by materialists, oh well, you just have knee-jerk things, that's what happens to you. But actually yogis, they are not knee-jerk. They don't have to breathe. The ultimate yogi is the Buddha yogi. They don't have to inhale. If there was not enough air for everybody, they might not inhale. And they might leave the oxygen to other beings. They just stop. And they leave. That would mean they would become to nothing, come to an end. They would move into a subtle plane where they don't need that kind of coarse materiality of oxygen. So these are foundational things. So now, let's now meditate. I've told you about death. Remember, you're juxtaposing it on a foundation of the preciousness of your own embodiment and pride and self-appreciation that you have in that, counting that blessing. And then realize that you're going to lose it just because there's no, when Buddha said everyone was selfless, or sometimes he would say soulless, even he would say that, just because he means there's no rigid fixed identity, like a little barcode that's always you, you know, like your social security number or something, or a little barcode, or a little mini you made of platinum that then hops over to ride in another body or something like that, you know, unchanged from what's living in you now. No, he meant is there's no fixed thing like that, but you're continuum. You're you as a marvelous weave and fabric and thread and tapestry that's always changing and growing or deteriorating. That super subtle soul continuum is not only not precluded by not having a fixed rigid one, but it is enabled by not having a fixed. If it was a fixed thing that never changed, then you wouldn't even connect to your fixed and changing body. There's no way it could connect. If it was fixed and never changed, then you'd connect it to a fixed and changed thing. It's changing by its connection. Or it's disconnected and irrelevant to your changing being. This is more the area where selflessness means relativity, basically, really, not non-existence. That's all I'm saying. I'll get into that in great detail later on. Today, or tomorrow, yeah, today. But now we're meditating. So now meditate on your death. It's definitely going to happen. Which you will, and when you meditate on these things, you know, you put before your mind a certain view, a certain awareness. But it doesn't hurt you to keep aware of a kind of debate in your mind where some voice might be saying to you, oh, I shouldn't really think about this because it's just nothing and it won't happen. What's the use, you know? When it happens, I won't know anything, I'll just disappear. And what is this thing about a continuum that's nothing? You know, there is no or I'm already nothing, or whatever kind of, you know, in other words, your different ideas about what it is will come in and interfere with that, with the real fact of what it is you are no longer continuing in what you identify as your course, your flesh and blood body, and flesh and blood and neural network and senses. You know, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, skin, mind. It's gone. And you don't know when. It could be any moment. And when it goes, what your soul continuum is it. So where is your soul continuum? How do you enrich that? How do you give to your soul? How do you nourish your soul? This is the king of all yogas, queen of all yogas. If you taste even a little bit of the meaning of this, as we went through it, you realize that this awareness of death and its potential immediacy is incredibly enlivening. There's nothing morbid about it. It makes you vibrant with appreciation and intensity of being in the moment, because it's such a magnificent moment, because you are a magnificent appreciator. You're a connoisseur of moments. You have these extraordinary sensitivities. and a beautiful sound, and a beautiful vision, and a beautiful scent, and a beautiful taste, and a beautiful touch, and a beautiful mental picture of all of that. There's a priceless, intense. And how do you take with you this openness and appreciativeness? How do you replace any instinct of fear, wishing to push stuff away and being closed off and narrow-minded and narrow experienced and excluding everything because you're frightened of something? How do you shift that gradually and gently and open more? This is where it leads you, and in every moment you can make a difference. Here we are now together, making the meaning of this moment, enjoying that meaning, drilling deep down into it, bringing the soul into it. Ding, second minute. Now, when I say bringing the soul into it, that's the job. And so how do we do that? Well, we don't have to only do it when we meditate on a retreat. We can bring this into daily life, because in India, all the traditions share what they call the tenfold path of positive and negative karma. Of which I call evolution, actually. Karma is not a mystical theory. It's a Darwinian, but not materialistic one. But I mean, it's not exclude material, but it's not exclusively materialistic. It's a Darwinian theory of evolution over multiple lives of the individual. That's the difference from Darwin. It's not just species. It's the individual moving from species to species. And the ethics is connected to evolution. It's evolutionary action. So when you're generous in the tiniest way, I mean, when you become aware of your mind, a little stinginess or a little narrowness or a little graspingness, and you're just open it a little and be a little generous, you don't have to involve a physical gift of any kind. It's like maybe a mental gift. Maybe you're judging someone or something, and then you give like the benefit of the doubt to the how you see that stupid person or something. Like, we have to practice this about our leaders now. They're giving us a good chance to practice that. And because we have a lot to judge there. So we give a benefit a little bit of doubt, not to the extent of voting, but a little doubt of some spiritual way. And ethical meaning, how does, you know, thinking about how you're interacting with others and trying to observe yourself interacting, being remembering yourself in interactions, and thereby seeing yourself from others' perspective. And that's the ethic. That's ethics. And then being tolerant when someone steps on the toe, like, yes, that was really painful. Please get off my toe. You know, but instead of like wanting to stamp on to kick them in the ankle or something, instead of that, restraining that and being open. And then speaking truth and not making, when one feels like a little white lie or something, or sometimes actually white lie is generous and good, because it's hard for someone to know something, you know, sometimes save someone's life. Did you see where that guy went? Some people are pursuing some poor person. You say, no, I didn't see. You did see, but you say, no, I didn't see. I don't know, maybe over there, you know. Send them on the wrong direction so that poor person can escape. You know, so sometimes you don't want to be, you don't want to use truth as a bludgeon. But on the other hand, when you be truthful, that means you're opening reality up to somebody else as you see it. And not backbiting people and like pitting them against one another, but being diplomatic and making them like each other and being friends with them by helping them be friends with each other. That's being more open again to their enjoying a friendship, not you wanting exclusively making them against each other so you can have them closer to be your friend. And speaking sweetly to them, and finally speaking meaningfully to them, and not babbling meaninglessly, and not being harsh with them. Those four things become openness in your speech. And then in your mind, being generous and detached in your mind, an open mind, and not greedily thinking, I would like this and that, and seeing something, I want one of those, and, you know, sort of diminishing that tendency, which we all have, naturally, but diminishing it a little bit, that's practice, that's opening the soul. And not feeling malicious about someone, that person said something about me, or maybe they don't like me, and not having any malicious mind toward them, but having a loving mind, or at least a tolerant one, tolerant on the way to loving. And then finally, being open-minded about theories, and not being fanatic and rigid in conviction and right about everything, or what's righteous and self-righteous, but being open-minded. And being aware of that experience is always something more, and the more things in heaven and earth that are dreamt of in your philosophy. So mentally open-minded. So all those tenfold, those are three of mind, four of speech, three of body. Oh yeah, and sexually. Not ever using it harmfully. Because sexuality is where people do naturally open to each other. And it's therefore one of the beautiful mammalian and human things. And where, you know, it relates to being born and living inside someone's body for almost a year. And then kindly going through the trouble, the labor of getting you out of there. And then nursing you and taking care of you as if you were still in there for a long time. That's amazing. And so, and then sexuality is where you kind of really give yourself. So therefore, to use that abusively on someone, in some traditions, it'll be called adultery, breaking the family. But it's not always only that. It's any kind of abusive, using anybody else as an object in some way, or harmfully. Any kind of abusive use of the sexual energy, sexual interaction. It's closedness versus openness, and in that moment, which biologically one tends to be open, to be even closed and subject, object, and me and you different, intensifying that there by being manipulative about it or something, that's particularly harmful physically. So killing, stealing, sexual abuse, lying, causing dissension, speaking sweetly and speaking meaningfully, and then being loving and being detached and generous and being open-minded. It's three of mind. So all those are practice. All of them are practice, and all of them are paths of evolution. And they all are ways of practicing at all times. They're like a meditation of living, while living.
This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the annual Tibet House US Menla New Year's Gathering happening online beginning December 29th, 2020. To learn more about this virtual gathering, please visit our websites at menla.org and tibethouse.us. Tashi Dalek, and hope to see you online during this year's New Year's Gathering.